The following is a production of BYU Broadcasting in cooperation with the Brigham Young University Division of Continuing Education.
In Greek mythology, the character Sisyphus is condemned by the Olympian gods to push an immense boulder up a hill, only to watch it roll back down again. Rinse and repeat through all eternity. Some thinkers, such as Albert Camus and Franz Kafka, have seen in Sisyphus a tragic but noble hero, ably and willingly performing his cruel punishment. Another way to see Sisyphus, however, is as a stubborn and foolish dupe, one who struggles not just in utter futility, but actually as a glutton for perpetual punishment. Kind of like the high school nerd who just can't get through his head that the most popular girl is never going to go out with him, no matter how many times he asks. I say if a wall won't budge, stop banging your head against it. A new novel by the accomplished New York-based pianist Jack Cole implies that a vast throng of elite young concert pianists today have condemned themselves to a Sisyphean life. With immense talent, world-class training, and perhaps a competition win or two to their credit, they think they'll rise to ethereal heights as solo performers. Cole's fiction, titled That Iron String, set in the highly competitive piano world, might be a cautionary tale for any hopeful competitor anywhere. There's only so much room at the top, and before you take on hills with boulders, you might want to know what you're getting into. But more than just a critique or exposé of a competitive culture fraught with peril, That Iron String invites the reader to grapple with a host of profound philosophical and artistic predicaments, adroitly woven into the plot of an intrigue-filled thriller. Without risking a spoiler now, I'll just say that a piano can be played in more ways than one, sometimes even with thunderous, irrevocable consequences. Jack Cole, author of That Iron String, is our guest today on Thinking Aloud. I'm Marcus Smith. Thanks for listening. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jack Cole to our program today. Cole is a pianist and a music director working in the greater New York City area. He has accompanied countless Broadway-credited singers in concert and cabaret settings. Jack Cole has served as music director and conductor for a host of musical theater productions over the decades. He's also fluent as a solo pianist in the classical tradition and in jazz of the American Songbook. Recently, Jack Cole has published a novel, That Iron String is its title, and it's set in the world of high-stakes, high-pressure world of piano competitions, and we're going to be talking about that world with him today. Great pleasure, as I mentioned. Jack Cole, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Marcus.
I want to start off with just this idea that the world of really serious artists and competent artists, it's never really a placid world, is it?
I think not. When I was a student, I had hoped it would be, but I increasingly knew that warnings I had read about the unlikelihood of having a certain career were more and more justified. I read in books, even when I was a teenager, of David Dubal warning about the unlikelihood of, for example, having a stable concert artist solo career. The books constantly warned of how unlikely that was, oftentimes saying that it would be more unlikely to, or more likely to become president of the United States than to be a solo artist. And I found that to be increasingly likely, no matter how much skill one built up. And it was also discouraging in a way, and encouraging for my fellow man to see how much competition is out there and how many people who are even better or even supernaturally better than oneself, how much trouble they have as well.
Well, I understand that the nature of the world, the competitiveness of this piano world, has it not just even gotten worse in the last decade or two?
I think so. As I mentioned, I remember reading warnings as if that world was unmanageable 30, 40 years ago when I first fancied that I wanted to pursue this world. I can only imagine how difficult it is for the young person. And yet, the fascinating aspect about these warnings is that they do not seem to take hold, that people don't take heed to the warning. And I think that's the fascinating psychology to it, is that there seems to be still an enormous amount of piano competition forums, if not even more than there were decades ago. And despite the warnings that I think are very fluently given, there's a great book right now by Robert Freeman called The Crisis of Classical Music in America, and it addresses all of these problems in a nonfiction and very scholarly-like way. And yet, students still seem to, in throngs, leap over the cliff in the hope that they'll be the one.
Well, what if it takes the right stuff to stay in that world and to succeed in that world? Are those type of people with the right stuff the kind of people who are most likely going to actually generate the kind of music worth listening to?
Seems very possible that it takes that kind of dedication to run into the fire regardless of what pain one is going to endure or likely death that one might meet with, figuratively speaking. Maybe it does take that kind of psychology. And I guess in the novel that I wished to write, I wanted to explore the psychology of a person, perhaps like you're suggesting, who has that kind of dedication, and yet, notwithstanding that kind of dedication and perhaps even supernatural gifts in terms of what is really necessary, still meets with a declining career. And I know that from my peers, people that I thought for sure would succeed and have not, and watched people like that fade into the oblivion, as so many competition winners do. They rise to the top and then oftentimes are never heard from again. What would happen to someone like that, who fused with a sense of philosophy in his mind, that had such a great self-faith for his fellow man and couldn't blame the system, could not blame the competitions, couldn't blame the field that he was drawn into? What would he do with that kind of disappointment, and how would he manage that anger, if you will, when he knew he was so able to meet with the field and yet not succeed?
There's another kind of pressure that meets up with artists, or artists meet up with it. And this pressure is not necessarily even the institutional pressure of a culture or a world of competition, but just competing against the music per se, the idea that you've got to grapple with a piece of a composition that could be daunting in utter privacy, without even going out into the world. That comes up in your novel, too, as well, doesn't it?
It does, and thank you for mentioning that. I wanted to imagine, and, well, I didn't have to imagine, so many pianists grapple with a fixed text in a piano competition, a kind of music, as you say, that is very daunting, whether or not it's in public or even in private when one grapples with it. And it has such a powerful canonical value in the 21st century now. Some of these great works have been with us for so long that one would wonder if you throw in a little bit of a love for old cinematic thrillers and the psychology that used to be explored in movies like that, where classical music was almost a character, a subliminal grist in the mind perhaps of a slight madman. What would happen if a pianist who could render these pieces at the top level still wouldn't succeed in the competition? And that often happens because obviously they're subjective, just like ice skating competitions. And I started to wonder what would happen if a pianist with almost Glenn Gouldian skill at rendering an ideal all the time still failed in a competition. Who would he blame? And I thought it would be very joyful, again, from my love of old Hollywood thrillers, when that was very common to use in old Warner Brothers films, music as an almost character. What would happen if the pianist starts to blame the music itself? And that was part of what gave birth to That Iron String.
That's a fascinating concept. Have you ever felt yourself in that position where the crush, the weight, the power of the music was just too overwhelming?
I have, because I've always been conscious of that terrible limitation of the kind of pianist that I am, where he's just good enough that no one in his circle tells him he shouldn't continue, but he knows he's not quite good enough to really distinguish himself, so that when he's under pressure, he occasionally can play very well, and then everyone has the impression that that's what he can do. But lingering in the mind is this almost personifiable sense that this canonical being that some of these great pieces are, they loom over us for decades. We hear them when we're children, and they become almost personifiable, that they are there on the platform with us, and if we don't serve them perfectly, that we can have a terrible sense of how we fail the canon. And I, again, thought it would be wonderful to have a character who thought he might service mankind by pushing against those personifiable beings of these pieces.
I don't want to spend too much time on a synopsis, and I don't even want to give away plot
sure.
line and, from your book, but suffice it to say that you have a couple of cousins, and they're both in this piano world, and one is apparently a phenomenal musician, the other perhaps a little less so.
Yes.
And this world is too big for both of them?
Well, it seems to be that from many people that I've spoken to, and from my own experience, the tragedy of today's conservatory and higher education world for music is that it is so good in its training that it produces far more people than the market can bear. And I think that's what's so fascinating about the competition world is, as I mentioned before, that that warning was more or less in place 3-4 decades ago. And yet one can only imagine with the streamlining of the education, the infinite access to recordings and great instruction and teaching and the chance to try in all sorts of forms one's playing so that nerves and all sorts of other issues are conquered. What does one do when there are so many able artists to represent all this canonical literature and yet not enough venues for them? That just seems to be a crisis that, though explored, still doesn't have an answer because more and more people are willing to, lemming-like, throw themselves into the fray.
In a very naive way, in a very romanticized way, we often think of music as just such a beautiful world, an inviting world. It summons us, but maybe you're saying there's something of a siren song there, that there are dangers lurking, and that is your book a cautionary tale?
In many ways, yes. Well said and well speculated. I think it's a cautionary tale in the sense that music is dangerous, perhaps to the classical musician, because he's so obligated to render the text exactly that he's somewhat like a technical rock climber. He engages in a sport that has immense risk and oftentimes is only left with the memory of the particular ascents, the risky climbs to the tops of mountains. And yet oftentimes, as a pianist myself and a classically trained pianist, I regret perhaps the liberties and the grammatical liberties that, say, a jazz artist can engage in, which may be closer to the original composers who wrote some of these classical pieces, wherein that they were engaging in a knowledge that was more the geology rather than the technical rock climber, so that they had the liberty to really enjoy the metaphorical aspects of music so that it could apply to other aspects of their lives, without always feeling that tenuous sense of possible failure if you don't render an exact text perfectly before the public all the time, and being judged, having one's ego so invested in all these efforts, and then being judged by perfect or lack of perfect renderings of a finite text. And one wonders if the original composers, the Chopins, the Beethovens, and the Liszts, ever existed within the cultural rigidity that we do when we play these pieces back now. One wonders if Liszt ever fretted to the degree we do at a piano competition. It really does make me wonder.
You brought up sports as an analogy, rock climbing, and I want to just push that a little further because we have a host of sports movies. A lot of people like to see sports movies where the protagonist is in a position of big challenges and facing them. And at some point becomes so demoralized. This is sort of the archetypical storyline, but is so demoralized that he or she wants to give it all up. And of course, the happy ending comes along where there's reason to stick around and then you conquer and are victorious overall. Your book doesn't do that, does it?
Well, it ends at the moment, perhaps, of the demoralization, where one wonders where the competition forum can take a great artist if they aren't chosen. And I'd like to think in a imaginative way that day, an imaginative reader could imagine where the sequel could take at least the survivors of the novel. And hopefully it doesn't leave people completely with a dark sense of the still great, great value of not only canonical music, art music, and all the classics that we love, but also its application metaphorically to our daily lives and to a musician's life. I'm not saying in any way that all of that training is wasted, even if one does not succeed specifically as a concert artist. I know I myself, after allowing myself some latitude to know that I could shift a little bit with this knowledge, found great joy as a generalist in the sense that chamber music, playing for singers, playing in all sorts of theater has been a great joy to me, and that I couldn't do it without having had that other training. So hopefully the novel has enough little suggestive edges that the narrator, at least, who survives the tale, somewhat like Ishmael, left there to tell what happens after the figurative Pequod sinks, is there not to tell you that all is lost.
Well, in the experience of music in my life, this is just fascinating to me because there are moments of bliss, there are moments of transcendent beauty, and all of those cliched ways we talk about the experience of music that really inspires us. But there are also times when the art or the experience of the art or the encounter with art, for whatever reason, either falls flat or completely sours on us as well. And we resist talking about those because they can be moments of resentment. And your figures in your novel can be resentful of not just the culture but also resentful of the very phenomenon of music.
Yes. I thought it would be fun to explore because we all have the experience perhaps when we're talking to strangers and getting to know someone and we might meet someone who doesn't like reading, we meet someone who doesn't like movies, or they say they don't like art. But it's almost without exception that we never meet someone who says they don't like music. And I thought it would be fun to explore, and interesting and important to explore, if that is really not true, that there may be exceptions to that and how that might be justified. And the novel's title, That Iron String, comes from Emerson, an author that means a great deal to me, because he has the phrase that we must bring all texts to judgment. And I thought that perhaps music isn't always brought to that same judgment, where we wonder if it always is the elevating thing that we think, or that sometimes lives are sacrificed in service to it when they should not be. Music, like any art, really should be representative of experience, representative of nature, representative of principles. And sometimes I wonder if students aren't told that maybe these pieces don't always elevate themselves to a place above experience. Maybe sometimes the representation isn't as high as our common experience. So I thought I would bring the Emersonian question, the Emersonian idea of bringing music as a text, music as an idea, music as an abstraction, to judgment and see what the protagonist came up with.
I'm just trying to wrap my head around these ideas because they're pretty meaty to try to follow. Is there a potential that what you are saying, and this is always risky to reduce somebody's novel to an idea like this, but that there's an idolatry around music that is unhealthy?
Music has meant so much to me and has done for me so much, as it has universally for mankind, that at first I must concede that it has done as much for me as everyone else. But in moments in the practice room, there are times when, yes, I have wondered if that it goes without challenge. Perhaps this is part of a latent puritanical part of my soul, where we sometimes know of the Puritan resistance to music and to dance and things that make us forget ourselves. But sometimes I wonder if there is an idolatry there in the sense that music being representative of experience is not necessarily as high as the experience itself, and that many people, so many people, because classical music, for example, is often, almost without exception, offered to young people as a virtuous, as a benign pursuit. It seems academically approved. I was never challenged. Everyone thought it was great. I thought I would almost take a old Puritan's speculative mind to it and see if it wasn't necessarily worth some challenging. I remember my grandmother, after a recital that I gave when I was a teenager, gave me a little framed picture with a little phrase, and I think many people know this phrase, where words fail, music speaks. And also I thought my novel would question the idea whether or not that was always true. And I think the idolatry that you speak of may be in part because we never challenge the notion that music, in a way, is always praised for speaking, so to speak, between the lines. But there are times that I wonder whether or not it is evasive, that it gives itself too much credit for not being definite in its meaning. And again, I thought I would explore, a la an old thriller aspect, a pianist who fails, though he has all the skills in the world in the competition circuit, can't blame his fellow man, doesn't want to blame the system, so can only maybe question that idolatry that you have suggested.
I'm visiting with Jack Cole. Cole is a pianist and a music director, a conductor, and also now an author of a novel titled That Iron String. And Jack, there are in this novel dark things, violent things, mysterious things that happen. Some of this is just a thriller. Mm-hmm. Did you ever, as you were writing this, feel like the mysterious elements of it, the detective elements of it, could somehow override what you wanted to say philosophically about the challenge of music, the problematic aspects of the music world and the world of competition?
That's a wonderful question. At the risk of invoking a cliche, the novel, to a certain degree, wrote itself. Because when I started out, I did not have the philosophical intentions that I began with. I began with the intention of writing something of a cliche story where a pianist struggles and then he meets with victory. And yet in my own experience, nothing in any way close to my protagonist, but in my own experience, I was encountering frustration in my own career, and yet from my kind of golly aw shucks upbringing, couldn't bring myself to blame anybody else or the musical system. And I knew the warnings had been given. So I thought, what would I do if a pianist way better than myself was in this position? And how would he start to build up a philosophical list of blame? And where would that take him? And that's how the novel started to write itself. So I felt I didn't want to write an expository piece, which I thought would be too difficult, perhaps, for the average reader. But I wanted to mix it with the experience I had had and yet the sincere philosophy that started to build up in me in terms of asking these questions and mix them into a thriller. Perhaps somewhat at the risk of, and I don't in any way try to equate myself with a Melville, but where we have someone like a Melville engaging in high burlesque of transcendentalism, let's say, and Emerson's principles or Thoreau's principles, and putting them into a madman's mouth and speech in an Ahab. So you have something like a Moby Dick, which is both treatise, both story, mm-hmm. all sorts of amalgamated ideas, and I thought I would make this kind of grand American mishmash, if you will, an Ivesian pot of stew, and see if I couldn't have both philosophy, both old cinematic thriller aspects and dark, mysterious principles in there as well.
So the book is out, people have read it, and now you're getting some feedback. And I'm very curious to know not just what the general reception has been for the book, but most particularly the reception from people like you who have been deep into this world of piano studies and training and competition, and if the reaction from them has been either confirming of your view of that world, or if people have taken issue with it?
Oh, thank you, Marcus. That's a wonderful question. I didn't think I'd get a chance to answer that. Many people have been very sympathetic, conceded right away that certain of these principles have occurred to them. Some grudgingly say it. And also some people have taken exception to the book, as if perhaps it has a polemical agenda of dismantling the concert system or dismantling music altogether. As an author, of course, it's gratifying to have such a range of reactions. It is surprising, frankly, especially the latter reactions, because within the context of a thriller, I was sure that the philosophy would be taken as speculation. But it is somewhat perversely pleasing to me to find that some people take great exception to it, that perhaps they'd never considered the notion that music could ever be challenged or that it could be looked at as an idolatry, as you suggested. And at the risk of not being, I don't want to sound that I was condescending or being wry, but sometimes a slight smile would form on my face when a very unexpected reaction would present itself from first readers who have come across the book sometimes either by my own solicitation or they've come across it by accident. Now I'm starting to get reactions via emails or other means where people take exception to it. So I'm fascinated to see what the ongoing reaction is, both from pianists and composers and conductors and other people in the music field.
How emotional have those voices been that are taking issue with it? Because to the degree that it's you've touched a nerve and that it's really touched on people in such a way that they're going to react, their degree of energy and their reaction could be very telling about maybe some truthfulness that you've touched on too.
Possibly. Any author, of course, as a book is making its way and making the rounds, starts to hear back from people who are slated to review the book. And several people, some pianists who have read the book, said that they could not in good conscience review the book because they thought, in a sense, that what, though he's a madman, that the protagonist is coming too close to trying to slay music as if it is a beast, as if it's a white whale. And as if perhaps that might be my latent goal myself as an actual man. And I found that somewhat thrilling to find that readers feel that there's so much verisimilitude in the book that they think it might be a threat to the actuality of pianists and the age-old music-making world, which of course is going to live on. But that has been the case, that there have been people who so take exception to the book that they don't want to have their names connected to it.
Well, if you were really a polemicist in this and you really wanted to sound the death knell for music as that false god that one should not idolatrously worship, if you were really there, then you would, with your book, probably not leave it as open-ended as it is.
I agree. I hope I don't give anything away when I say that at the end, notwithstanding all the darkness, the thriller aspects, which I hope people take away some fun and thrill, because I grew up watching films like Deception with Bette Davis and Claude Rains, where music was very much almost a character in a murder mystery setting. I still hope that there is that epilogue sense where the narrator walks away, even if into evening, the sense that not only does life go on, but music goes on. And if anyone who's also, say, disturbed by a Moby Dick, they'll will recall that despite the power of an Ahab and all of his dark speculation, the Pequod does sink and the ocean rolls on.
Let's conclude our conversation today, Jack, if you would, by giving whatever advice you would recommend to some young, bright-eyed, enthusiastic, talented young pianist who's headed into this world. Would you even want to pull them aside and say, hey, let's be cautious here and you really need to know what you're getting into?
I might, but at the same time, I'm put in mind of a wonderful phrase that I remember I read years ago in David Duvall's Reflections from the Keyboard, where he asked Claudio Arrau about the dangers of young pianists going into the field. And Arrau had a wonderful phrase that I have always remembered, and I wonder if I also keep it in my heart when I would speak to young people, that any talent is invaluable so long as there's sincerity. And I believe that. I also believe that any talent, even if they're moderate or even a poor talent, so long as they know that life will ask them to pivot and that they should be able to show latitude, and even if they study the piano with the idea of playing Rachmaninoff concertos all their lives, well, even if they don't end up doing that, all that practicing of the Rachmaninoff concertos, well, that might make them a great sight reader. It might make them a great leader accompanist, a great theater music director, all of those things. So long as you are not so hell-bent on one target, there are many other targets there that all the archery practice of the practice room may make you quite ready for.
Jack Cole, such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Marcus, it's been an honor. Thank you.
Jack Cole, our guest here on the program today. He's a pianist and a music director working in the New York City area and recently has published a book. The title of this novel, a thriller, is That Iron String by Jack Cole, Cole spelled K-O-H-L. We hope you come to our program again and listen to any of our past interviews or this interview again from our website. You can find us easily online at classical89.org/thinkingaloud. I'm Marcus Smith. Thanks for listening.
Thinking Aloud is a production of BYU Broadcasting, made possible in cooperation with the Brigham Young University Division of Continuing Education.